forward to a special day with our guest speaker, and we'll start our Sunday school hour with number 736 in your old hymnals, "I Will Sing of the Mercies of the Lord," number 736. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing, I will sing, I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness, thy faithfulness. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing, I will sing, I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord.
Welcome to the Sunday, excuse me. Welcome to the Sunday School Hour. It's great to see you all here. I have something, something in my throat. Anyway, it's great to have Brother Brian Lauer with us today. He's from the St. Cloud, Minnesota area. And he's going to speak on things related to the flood this hour, and then the worship hour at 10:30 and 1 o'clock this afternoon. Other things somewhat related and very much something that we have a burden for. So we're going to go ahead and have a word of prayer. Sunday school classes will all stay in here. And then we can go right into the message, give Brian maximum amount of time. We thank you, Father, for a beautiful day, the liberties that we have, for the opportunity we have this day. Equip us, Lord, and guide us that we might comprehend more what the scriptures say, what science confirms, and the way we can give God glory. And so we thank you for Brother Lauer coming here. God bless him and his wife and his family. And bless his ministry. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Right?
Well, thank you so much. It is such an honor and a privilege to be here today. Thank you for coming. And we're gonna cover my favorite talk. So I'm pretty excited to be here. My favorite talk and then my most important talks. And I've got a ministry called Solidify Your Faith, where I help people solidify their faith in the Bible by looking at science. And now I'm just going around telling people what powerful evolutionists have planned for humanity. So I give freedom talks. And the last time I was in Sioux Falls, I spoke at this HOLD summit, Health Ownership and Liberty Development. Was anybody there at all? Okay, yeah, that's very important that we get the freedom message out. And it was just not too far from here. It was at some wedding place. And we just had a great time. And I've given talks at colleges and vacation Bible schools, and I'm just trying to get the message out. And 2 years ago, I had a booth at the fair trying to get people to think about creation, and we started a local creation club. And I encourage that every town should have a creation club because they're getting bombarded with evolution in the government schools. They need somewhere to get the truth. And I'd have the question of the day. I did surveys. First one was, what came first, the chicken or the egg? And the survey said 60 for the chicken and 56 for the egg. So that one was pretty close. And how did life begin? Somehow or God, and you can look at the college textbook out on the table, that's how they explain life, somehow, despite the harsh environment, the first living cells appeared. So God won that one, 137 to 30-something. And then I asked, did hydrogen and helium turn into people? Because that's what the Big Bang says. You know, Big Bang produced hydrogen, helium, a little bit of lithium, and here we are. And nobody bought that one. No, 161. Yes was 52. And some people didn't know, 45. And then the last one, what are you? A mutated animal or made in the image of God? And the image of God won, 98 to 17. So they are pounding that evolution with all our tax money, and people aren't buying it. And I just like to ask these questions that can expose the errors in their thinking. Then I'll go to the college, too. And I did this quite a bit last few months. How did we get here? Creation, evolution, intelligent design, or don't know? And this was at the State College in town. I thought evolution would just be a landslide, and it wasn't. It was really rather close. It was neck and neck there for a while. And then I needed a break. This world was getting to me, and I needed a break. So I coached some junior high basketball, and that was an experience. You could do a whole message on what I learned teaching and what they learned. And again, I've got a ministry. Next month I'll be in Pennsylvania doing a creation conference, and on the way back I'll be in Fresno, Ohio, and Chicago at the university, and on the way out there, I'll be in Baraboo, Wisconsin, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Sunday school, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening, so pray for that. So it's a lot of fun, and the way, if you want to be part of this ministry, I forgot the DVDs, I apologize about that, but there's a box in the back. If you make a donation, we'll get a clipboard there where you can put your name, and I'll send a bunch of DVDs, and you should have them by this Sunday or next Sunday. And on that DVD, there's three talks, and one of them is Get in the Game, and I guarantee you've never seen a talk like this one. It's comparing the creation versus evolution as far as basketball, and we play Pictionary. You've never seen one like that. But so that's where I am. That's where I'm going. I'm going wherever God opens the doors. And just yesterday, somebody asked me to be the MC at a Hydroplate conference. There's never been a Hydroplate conference, and this is going to be online. You can Zoom it if you want. It's going to be September 21st to 23rd, so a Thursday night, Friday and Saturday. And and I said, well, I've never emceed, but if no one else wants to, I'll do it. And so I'm looking forward to that. So wherever God opens the doors, that's what I want to do. And all right, enough of that. Let's get into the message. Does anybody know what this is? Yes. Should I move it up higher? Or can you adjust it better? No. Move it up higher? Sorry about that. How about that? We good? Okay. Sorry about that. All right. Well, you guys obviously weren't in senior math when Mr. Wabicki wrote that on the board. He said, obviously, that's a bear climbing up the other side of a tree, right? See, now you can see it, right? I'm artistic, so I colored it in. You can see it a little better. So if you ever see something like that, oh, that's a bear climbing up the other side of the tree. And once you see it, you can't unsee it, okay? And that's what I want to do with the earth. You know, the earth, how did it get the way it is? I mean, there's a lot of mountains, there's a lot of ranges, and this hydroplate theory explains a lot. It's got a lot of the answers. But if you don't know what the questions are, the answers won't mean much. So let's go through some of these questions. How do you get marine fossils 5 miles above the sea level on Mount Everest? What causes a mountain to rise? What's the mechanism, energy, and force that causes a mountain to rise? And what formed the Mariana Trench? That's the deepest part in the ocean. How did that get sucked in? And why are most of the trenches in the Pacific? And why is the Pacific so much different than the rest of the oceans? They've got a lot more volcanic activity. They've got 40,000 volcanoes at the bottom. And how did the Mid-Oceanic Ridge form? It's a 46,000-mile mountain ridge at the bottom of the ocean. How did that form? And how come why are most of the mountain ranges parallel to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge? And how did the 90 East Ridge form? That's a ridge that's pretty much straight up and down, pointing straight at the Himalayas. And how do plateaus form? And it's a really a big mystery, according to this guy. You know, what mechanism would cause a large volume of low-standing continents to rise rapidly a mile in the air? And the Himalayan one is like 3 miles in the air. How does that happen? What caused inland seas to form? You know, where did all the sediment come from? I've always wondered that. You know, where did all that sediment come from that averages a mile deep on all the continents? And what caused it to be so evenly mixed? Because you can have a bunch of sand on the driveway. It's not going to turn into cement unless you have a cementing agent. What turned that sand into sandstone and that lime into limestone? What turned the sediment into rock? It had to be evenly mixtured with a mix with something that would cause it to stick together. And what lays down layers of sedimentary rock continent-wide? Anybody ever been to the Grand Canyon? Anybody? Okay. Those layers aren't just there. They go all over the continent. You don't lay layers like that down with a local flood. This was a worldwide catastrophic flood. And not only are they all across the continent, they're all across the world. That same layer points strongly to a worldwide flood. How do canyons form under the ocean? How do petrified trees form? How did lineaments form? Those are linear cracks in the surface of the earth. How does that happen? How does a canyon form under 2 kilometers of ice in Greenland? And how do lakes form under 2 miles of ice in Antarctica? How does that happen? It's liquid water. This is a textbook, 8th grade earth science, government school. The South Pole is mostly covered by ice, but fossils show that crocodiles, dinosaurs, and palm trees once lived on that land. How do you get that? And how do you get on the opposite of the world? How do badgers, snakes live in permafrost up above the North Pole or the North Arctic Circle? And lately I've been, my son went to Pensacola Christian College, and his roommate was from Inuvik, Canada, which is north of the Arctic Circle. And it's always 20 below or up there. And I asked him, hey, Norman, how do you run the water? I mean, we run our pipes in the ground so they don't freeze. Your ground is frozen. How do you do that? And he said, well, we got these, they call them utilidors. You either drive under them or drive over them, and they're heated pipes, and they have to be. And what a mess if the power goes out. And so whenever I think it's too cold in Minnesota, I just take a look at Inuvik, Canada, and thought, man, we're in a heat wave. And then what froze the mammoths? And how come a mammoth froze standing up? You don't hear much about that one, with identifiable food in its stomach. And how did it get so cold so fast in the summer? Because that's what the food said, it was summer. And how come it didn't thaw out? And what caused the ice age? Evolutionists can't answer that one. And why aren't there any glaciers in parts of Alaska? When I saw this, I was jumping up and down. You can ask my wife, because it's hard to find a map of the glacier. And there's no glacier in Alaska? And parts of Siberia, where there's permafrost today, and there wasn't a glacier back then? How do you tie that together? Why do comets have stuff from the Earth? Water, salts, limestone, cubanite, and some of that stuff had to be formed in water, scalding water. And outer space is really cold. How's that going to happen? And how do asteroids get moons? It's really hard to get. I mean, it has to be just perfect. How do you get asteroids to come together in a peanut shape instead of blowing each other to smithereens, like this guy says? It's a major mystery how two objects, each the size of skyscrapers, could collide without blowing each other to smithereens. This is especially puzzling in a region of the solar system where gravitational forces would normally involve collision speeds of 4,500 miles an hour. Anybody ever play pool? Do those pool balls stick together? No, they bounce off. And that's why you can't get planets to form. All those things that are supposed to stick together, they bounce off. And how do you get rounded boulders in space? When things collide together, they're going to have jagged edges, but there's find rounded boulders in this comet 67P. How do you get these chondrules? It's like melted rock in these meteorites. How does that happen? And why is the moon so different? The near side is pounded, and the far side is peppered, and the far side is 30 degrees colder than what they expected. Why is that? And again, the far side is, the dark side's on the near side, that's lava flows. And the near side's been pounded, the far side's been peppered, and it's counterintuitive because the Earth should shield the near side, especially with the gravitational pull. It's really hard to hit the near side of the moon from outer space, and yet that's the side that's pounded. And why is the Earth's oldest rock found on the moon? How'd that get there? And so we have a lot of these questions, all right? But if there was one theory that could tie them all together, wouldn't that theory be worthy of study, right? And that's what the hydroplate theory does. And the Occam's razor, the simplest theory explaining the most details is probably correct. So this is the simplest theory. And it does explain the most details, and it makes accurate predictions. Oh, is this thing in your way? Can you guys see the screen okay? Should I take it down? You're okay? Yeah, okay. All right, if it's in the way, let me know. And Walt Brown, driving through South Dakota back in the 70s, and he said he heard on the radio that somebody found the Ark. They said they found the Ark on a mountain. And he thought, that's crazy. You know, he's an evolutionist. Oh, there's no Ark. But there's nothing to do in South Dakota besides count wall drug signs, right? And so he just thought, okay, well, humor them. If they found the Ark on a mountain, well, that would mean the whole world was covered with water. And if the whole world was covered with water, that would mean there would be a whole bunch of plants and animals that get buried in mud and turned into fossils. And he thought, wait a minute. If fossils are evidence for a flood, where's the evidence for evolution? And he's like as sharp as they can get. He was graduated from West Point. He was in the Army Ranger, got his PhD from MIT in mechanical engineering, so he's about as sharp as he gets. And he ran the B'nai Military Lab, so he had dozens of PhDs and hundreds of scientists working for him. So his colleagues are really sharp. And he started to ask them, what evidence do you have for evolution? And they didn't have any. And after a couple of years, he became a creationist, and he came up with this theory called the hydroplate. And if you want to see it animated, go onto Brian Nichol's webpage, or it's on YouTube. Just search Brian Nichol, N-I-C-K-E-L, and he animates it, and it's amazing. So what did Walt Brown do? He looked at the Bible, and he saw how this theory is based on the Bible. And he looked at these verses. To him that stretched out the earth above the waters, earth above the waters, Psalm 136:6. The earth and all the inhabitants thereof are dissolved. I bear up the pillars of it. The earth bears up on pillars. That's interesting. And by the word of the Lord were the heavens made and all the host of them and the breath of his mouth. He gathered the waters of the sea together as a heap and laid them up in storehouses. Water in storehouses. And for him that founded upon the seas and established it upon the floods. So the earth is established on the water. And then the most detailed day in history, the 600th year of Noah's life in the second month, the 17th day of the month, in the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were open. And people say that Genesis is poetic. Does that sound poetic, you know, or historical? They're going out of their way to say which day it was. Genesis is history, not poetic. So the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Or who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? Job 38:8. So there's water breaking out of the earth. Or who shut up the sea with doors as it break forth as it issued out of the womb? I did that. And then the waters that stood above the waters stood above the waters, and at thy rebuke, at the voice of thy thunder, they hasted away. You know, the mountains. Can you imagine the sound of mountains forming? This is Psalm 104, 5 and 9. And then thou entered into the springs of the sea. There's water underneath the ocean. And Job wrote about that. And they didn't find the springs till 1977. So how would they know that? And also, I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. And this is in Jonah. How did they know there were mountains in the ocean? You know, the Bible is a supernatural book because men could not have known that. And he took those verses and he came up with this theory, and it's a few hundred pages long. This is the 8th edition. And you know a theory is good, a book is good, when it goes up in value when it's out of print. You used to buy these brand new for $35. Now you're going to be lucky to find it for $100. And the 9th edition is coming out, hopefully sooner than later. Okay, so his one assumption, and I had a college professor look at this, because I said, you don't have a theory for Grand Canyon. And they don't. They can't explain it from their worldview. And I said, this theory does. And she looked at it. She had it for 6 months, and we got together later, and we talked for about an hour, hour and a half. And she said, the science works if the assumption is right. I just don't believe the assumption is right. And this is just one assumption. His one assumption is half of the ocean was inside the earth, about a mile down. So there's a layer of water. Just think of the earth as a big apple. Okay, the crust, the apple skin is 60 miles thick, made of granite. And then there's a layer of water about a mile thick. And then under that, there's the basalt. So, and then the granite and the basalt will be touching each other. Those will be the pillars. Okay, that's just the one assumption. See, most theories, they look at what we have and they try and figure out how we got there. You know, they look at the effect and try and figure out the cause. This is backwards. He's setting up the cause and letting the laws of physics go at it and see what the effects will be. So he's setting up the one assumption, one cause, half the ocean inside the earth, what would happen? Well, the moon's going to tug on it. You know, you got high tide and low tide. So it's going to stretch and compress the crust, stretch and compress. That's going to add heat, energy to it. The water gets hotter and hotter and hotter. It wants to boil, but it can't. And so at 705 degrees at 3200 PSI, it becomes supercritical, where it's not really water and it's not really steam, but whatever it is, it dissolves things like crazy. So now it starts to dissolve the granite above and the basalt below and makes all these elements like limestone and chalk and quartz, and all that stuff's getting dissolved in there, and there's getting more and more pressure, hotter and hotter, crust is getting weaker and weaker, and then when the Noah's flood came, it cracked. There was one crack in the crust of the earth, and that crack went in two directions at 3 miles an hour, so in 3 miles a second, in 2 hours, it circumvented the globe. And that's where you find the mid-ocean. And people say, well, if that happened, and then the water shot up like crazy, so it could rain for 40 days and 40 nights. See, with our atmosphere, it can't do that. But the water was coming from inside the earth, came down for 40 days and 40 nights. And people will say, well, if that happened, wouldn't it leave a mark? And the answer is, yeah, it did. It's called the Mid-Oceanic Ridge. That's how it was formed. That was where the crack was, and all that stuff shot up. And he thinks it started up by Alaska because it kind of hits together, and then it'll stop spreading. And so he just ran the movie backwards. Okay, and so what's happening? Now you got two 60-mile cliffs with water erupting out, and then they think it's about 300,000 pounds per square inch underneath that 60 miles of granite with all that heat. So it's just, and then it's going to go up to almost no pressure in our atmosphere. It's just going to erupt out of there with super, super critical, super pressure. And what's going to happen is all that granite's going to crumble into that flow, because you can't get a cliff 5 miles high on Earth because it's going to crush the rock below. And this is 60 miles high, so it's crumbling down into that water. That's just where we're getting the sediment. And then the crust gets, all the sediment's going up, goes across the ocean, goes across the continents. That's how we get the continent-wide sediments. And then they get sorted out with the waves, and it goes worldwide. And he thinks, he doesn't think the Atlantic Ocean was there. You know, they try and stick it together with Pangaea, and it doesn't really fit. But if you put the continents around the mid-oceanic ridge and leave a few hundred miles of erosion, then it fits really well. So the ridge above the Atlantic Ocean gets wider and wider and wider and wider, and pretty soon there's nothing pushing down on it, so it's going to bulge. So now it's like you got like somebody lifted a train track. Lift one end of a train track, the train's going to start rolling. And that's what happened with the continents, because they're still floating on that water. They start sliding. You got Europe and Africa going to the east, and you got North America and South America sliding to the west, and they keep going until they meet resistance, and then they form the mountains. That's why most of the mountain ranges are parallel to that mid-Atlantic ridge. And I think it's twice as you notice up there, the Rockies are twice as big as the Andes, and I think it's because North America slid over the ridge. I think that's what happened there. And then there's a tremendous pressure with a lot of force and heat, and that's going to make our coal and oil and metamorphic rocks and marble and diamond. And all those things have carbon-14 in them, which means they're not millions of years old. And this is up in British Columbia. Those are the folded mountains. And it's, you can do a science experiment at home. You know, just take your finest piece of china and bend it, see how that works. Well, these are rocks, and they bent. They had to be pliable when they got pushed together. It'd be like a rug going up against a wall. It's going to buckle. Or a car hood on an accident. It's going to buckle. That's what happened to the sediments that got pushed and a resistance. And then this granite, when that got compressed like that, there's going to be a lot of heat. That quartz is going to melt first, and it's going to have all these. It looks like marble cake. And to put that in scale, there's 15. The trees on top of that canyon are 15 feet tall. This is a huge canyon, Gunnison Canyon. And they got that same kind of rock. You know, anybody in casting or molding to try and get it infused with that stuff, it's really difficult. But I think that's just the granite that melted, and then the different parts of the granite, I think it was quartz. And the same kind of rock they find at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And that's a whole nother talk. So there's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And you notice it's stretched in two directions. Rock, if you push it together, is going to kind of crumble like we just showed you. That's how if they're pressed together. But rock, if you stretch it out, it's just going to have one crack to release the pressure, and it's just going to go straight. And that's what we see in the mid-ocean and mid-Atlantic Ridge. They're straight cracks. These are tension cracks. That thing was, how do you make a mountain by stretching it? 46,000 miles. Okay, and then he says, now you got the mountains. You got a big mass on a small base, and the mountains are going to sink in. Well, if something sinks in, something's got to rise up. That's how you get the plateaus. It's hydraulics. You got the big mountain going down, and then it kind of piecemeals and breaks up. It just gets pushed up. That's the force, gravity, bringing down some big, heavy mountains. And so that's what happened. And then you got the lava that's going to seep up there sometimes. It's going to go on top. It's going to make it hard on top. So if a big bunch of water comes by, like when the Grand Canyon broke, those lakes, and it's going to wipe away all that stuff, and it's going to leave a butte. And that's where you got Red Butte. Okay, and that's right down there, right below where Grand Canyon was formed. Okay, so now if you got something, and with the Mid-Oceanic Ridge rising up, something else has to sink in, right? So what sunk in? It was the Pacific Ocean. That's why the Pacific is so much different. That's why the trenches are in the Pacific and not the Atlantic. And it's the Ring of Fire. All that got sucked in, and all that lava flow, and then you got all those lava, those volcanoes going up underneath. And that's why the Mariana Trench is there. That's why it's so much different. Most of the trenches are there. And there was even a continent that got sucked in. They call it Zealandia, about the size of India. And Walt Brown had predicted they'd find some granite in the Pacific Ocean, and that's what they found. And they found evidence of land-based fossils. So that happened during the flood. It sucked them down. Sunken continent, size of east of Australia. And so that's why you get all those volcanoes. Okay, and how do you get the continental shelf? You know, you got the continents and the shelf, and then the slope, and then the shelf. Well, when the granite, it's going to slam down, and then when a bunch of pressure builds up, it's going to shoot up, and it's going to keep slamming and shooting up. So most of the erosion is going to be at the point, and that's going to make it beveled, and that's why you get the slope, and then the drop off, the shelf, and then the slope, and that's why. And then how do you get submarine canyons? At the end of most rivers, there's a big canyon in the ocean. How do you cut a canyon in the ocean? Well, the continents were higher, is what Walt Brown says. The water rushed off into the oceans. The continents have sunk, and that raises the ocean. That's how you get the canyon at the mouth of those under the water. And how do you get a canyon under 2 miles of ice or 2 kilometers of ice in Greenland? And it's cut by a river? Well, the water gushed off into the Pacific Ocean, or the water, and it cut the canyon, and then the ice age filled it up. Same thing with Antarctica. 2 miles of ice, and Russia's drilling down there, you know, and the environmentalists are saying, don't do it, don't do it, you're going to destroy their ecosystem. And the Russians said, thanks for your advice, your input, and they kept on drilling. And now the evolutionists are saying, boy, this is an isolated population, we're going to find stuff that we've never seen before. And Bob Enyart from Real Science Radio, he's a pastor out in Denver, he said, no, you're going to find just every normal stuff. And the Bible-thumping pastor was right. That's what they found, just normal stuff. And also they found 91 new volcanoes beneath Antarctica's ice. You think that could melt some ice? Maybe it's not the global warming hype that they're pushing. I encourage people to watch or read Inconvenient Facts. It's out there on the table. It just destroys all the global warmest alarmism, all their icons. And then also co2science.org if you want to see. The main thing with climate change is carbon dioxide is plant food. It's not pollution. And if we had more carbon dioxide, we'd have more food and less droughts. We should not be trying to limit it. But they can't control us if we don't limit it. That's what the next talks are for. And then why wasn't there a glacier in Alaska? Well, because the continents were higher and the oceans were warmer, and it came down as rain instead of snow when it was closer to the oceans. And then when it went inland and higher up. And then how do you get the ice age? You know, the evolutionists, they can't explain it. They got 40 theories, which means none of them work. And once the ice started coming, it should just keep on going. What stopped the ice age? Because it keeps reflecting more and more heat up. Well, this theory explains it. To have an ice age, it has to snow more than it melts year after year after year. Okay? So for it to snow so much, it needs to have warmer oceans. And it can't melt in the summer. So how are you going to have warmer winters and cooler summers? Well, the warmer winters are due to the oceans that are warmer. And the cooler summers are due to the elevation higher. And also all that volcanic activity is going to have a lot of aerosol in the atmosphere, which is going to reflect a lot of the heat from the sun. So you're going to have 400 or 500 years of it snowing more than it melts, and you're going to get the ice age like this. And then during that process, the oceans are cooling off, so there's going to be less snow. The atmosphere is clearing up, so there's going to be more heat. So it took about 200 years for it to melt the ice. And we're still recovering from it to a certain extent. It's not the global warmest, what they want you to believe. And the same thing with Siberia. It was closer to the ocean, and so it came down. And there was one volcano back in 1815, Mount Tambora. It made it so they had it in New England. They had the year without summer. Snowstorms came in June. Ice formed in the lakes in July and August. So that's what one volcano could do. Could you imagine if there were hundreds of volcanoes putting that stuff up there? It's going to get cold. All right. And so how did the mammoths freeze? Well, mammoths are not Arctic animals. You know, they call them woolly mammoths, but it's not. It's hair. They could not survive up there. I mean, your nose gets cold going outside. Can you imagine if it was 6 feet long? And they eat, you know, 300 pounds a day. They drink 30 gallons a day. There's not that much food. There's not that much water up there. Those are temperate animals. So how do you get temperate animals to freeze? Well, some of this stuff was coming up with such tremendous force that it went into the atmosphere and got super cold. Gravity got a hold of it and sucked it back down and buried them in muddy hail and dry ice. And then the flood came over them. I'm not sure how much they were buried in, but it was underneath the flood and it didn't melt out. And now the rivers are cutting through that stuff, and then it's exposing a lot of these mammoths. And you can see this one in St. Petersburg, Russia. It was frozen standing up. And it was flash frozen. Any deer hunters here? What's the first thing you do when you shoot the deer? You gut it. Get the heat out of there, or it'll spoil the meat. Can you imagine the heat in a mammoth's stomach? But it flash froze. It was super cold. It doesn't get that cold on Earth. And so it was the stuff, the muddy hail, the dry ice coming down, burying them. And then, okay, why didn't they thaw out? Well, that brings us to the big roll. And that's, if you have, it has to do with the Himalayas. See, the mountains on the north and the mountains on the south pretty much cancel out, except for the Himalayas. There's nothing in the southern hemisphere to cancel that out. So now you got a big bulge on the northern hemisphere, and according to the laws of physics, that bulge is going to try and get to the side. So that's what he's going to do. That orange spot is weight, and it's at the top, and it ends up at the side. So it took something that was at the side and brought it to the top, and that's what happened with the mammoths. You know, they're living in, so you see how that goes to the side? So the mammoths are living in Mammothville, getting fat and sassy and eating a bunch and drinking a bunch. And then the Himalayas brought the side up to Mammoth Chill. And when that happened, you know, it brought all that, the tortoises and the alligators and the redwoods to the top. They can't live there now. And that's what brought the tropical palm trees down to the South Pole. And what also happened is it ripped the earth, because the earth isn't round. There's a little bulge at the equator. And when it shifted through that bulge, It ripped that part of the earth because of the pressure, and that's the 90 East Ridge. That's where it ripped. That's why it's pointed straight at the Himalayas. It's a fascinating theory. And then this, I just threw this in there too. It's like, well, did you know the moon doesn't go around our equator? You ever thought about that? Our moon doesn't. It's like one of the only things in the solar system where the moon doesn't go around the equator. Besides all the planets, we don't go around the sun's equator, so it's kind of hard on that theory. You know, maybe the rotation, maybe the angle got messed up at that point in time too. Because if it did go around the equator, we'd hardly ever get a solar eclipse. It goes around on the same plane as the Earth around the sun. Okay, what caused the inland seas? Okay, and the lineaments, that's the straight geologic features. It has to do with what quartz are made of. Granite. Granite's made of 27% quartz, feldspar, mica, and hornblende. And quartz is piezoelectric, which means if you stretch it or you compress it, it's going to make a spark. And so this thing, this granite's fluttering up and down as the water's going out, and so it's getting tension on top, it's getting pressed in the middle, and that's causing sparks. And they've seen lightnings. You know, when there's earthquake, they see sparks coming out of the ground. I think that's the That's the piezoelectric of the granite. And so now it's kind of like plasma. You know how there's lightning, and then you got the air comes together and it makes the thunder? Well, in rock, there's no room to do that, but it does come together with pressure and it makes the heavier elements. That's how this theory says uranium was formed. It crushed together, made these particles together. They're radioactive and they decompose into the valley of stability. And because God said it's very good, would it be very good to have uranium where you could get birth defects? And so they think that the radioactive material was formed during the flood. And with all that radioactivity, you're going to have more heat, and that's going to make parts of the crust weaker, and they're going to explode out of there. So that's how you get the inland seas. Okay? And so then the chondrules, that's the melted meteor rock stuff and meteorites. It's when it slams down, there's a lot of force. And that could kind of, for lack of a better word, melt those pieces of rock. It causes that electrical charge, that Z pinch, makes the chondrules. They get pushed to the side, wait for enough pressure to build up, and then they shoot up, not only into our atmosphere, but into outer space. And they're flying around out there. And that's how he thinks that, okay. And then that's why the deuterium, that's heavy. Hydrogen is normally a proton and an electron. Deuterium has a proton, electron, and a neutron. So it kind of got mixed up there. And so their comets have twice as much deuterium as the oceans. So I think the ocean diluted half of that stuff that was coming out. And so now you got stuff shooting up out there with so much force. Some of it not only escapes our atmosphere, it escapes our gravitational pull. So now you got these rocks and frozen carbon dioxide and water and like dirty snowballs flying around out there. Anybody know what a dirty snowball in space is called? Anybody? I think I heard it.
Comet.
That's right. He thinks the comets came from Earth. That's why he predicted. Kevin Lee, he's going to be talking at that conference. That's why they predicted when you find out what's in a comet, you're going to find stuff from Earth. And the Bible-thumping creationists were right. And the evolutionists who say, no, comets came from the Oort cloud way out there, so we're going to find nothing like the Earth. And they were I encourage you to listen to that on rsr.org. They didn't want to publish what they found, but they did. And they wouldn't say it came from Earth. They said it came from the inner solar system. And so they found water, salt, silicates, crystalline silicates, limestone, clay, cubanite. And cubanite needs to be formed in scalding water, olivine. And Walt Brown predicted they'd find olivine. And he was right. And if they say they found bacteria and comets, then that's how life came here? No. The bacteria came from Earth. All right. And again, Kevin Lee and RSR does a great job with that. RSR.org, search Kevin Lee. And it's phenomenal because he went to these presentations where Dr. Brownlee, he's the head of the Stardust mission. He was, the guy who got that satellite, he got that thing up there, got a piece of a comet and brought it back. He said, you're going to find stuff from Earth. And he gave him one of Walt Brown's books. Or he gave him the website to it, one of the two. And he said, just read this under your covers, just for intellectual curiosity. And the creationists are right. Even with that Webb Space Telescope, there's jaw-dropping. People are just, this turns everything on their head. But the creationists predicted it. And then Jason Lyle, he even predicted how they'd respond when they were wrong. He said, they're going to say that galaxies formed much quicker than we anticipated. And that's exactly what they said. Okay, and you can see the origin of comets. This is our local Twin Cities Creation Science Association. We have a speaker come in every month. Sioux Falls should have one. You really should think about getting a creation science club going and then just have speakers or show movies or something. And there's a need, and we'll talk. That's the battle. You think the world's a mess right now? It's because God's word is losing. Satan's lies are winning, and it's all based on ground zero of creation versus evolution. So we need to win that battle, and I encourage people to start a club. Maybe have one in Renner, and maybe one in Sioux Falls. But it's a battle. It's worth it. Okay, and so then they go up, and how do you get peanut-shaped asteroids? How come they come together so smoothly? Well, it's because they're coming from the same spot at the same speed. They come together gently. With the Big Banger theory, this is just random. They're going to come in, they're going to break apart.
But if they're coming from the same spot at the same speed, the biggest things will stick together, and some of them might even make moons. And that's how you get rounded boulders in Comet 67P. The only way it gets rounded is if it's going through a fast flow of water before it gets shot up there. Boom. And that's what happened. It went through the fountains of the Great Deep. And you say, well, if that happened, wouldn't it leave a mark? Yeah, it did. It left a mark on the moon. That's why the near side is pounded and the far side's not. It's peppered. That's why the rock, oldest rock on Earth, is on the moon. It came from the moon. What projected it up, propelled it up there? The fountains of the Great Deep. And so this theory has a lot of validity. And he's made predictions, accurate predictions. He's got about 50 predictions. And they're astounding predictions. It's not a prediction, oh, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. No. He predicted that they'd find pooled water underneath mountains. And there's no way water can get down there because that granite, when it's about, 5,000 feet deep, it's like putty. It just seals it all off. And they dug holes, and they're astounded. They predicted deep channels under the Bosporus and Gibraltar, and he was right. He predicted salt on Mars, and he was right. Asteroids are flying rock piles, and he was right. And they'd have rounded boulders, and he was right. And the water inside of asteroids, and he was right. And carbon-14 in old bones, and he was right. And there's probably 40 other ones that he's made these predictions. And so what I've showed you is Walt Brown, who I believe is the Isaac Newton of our day. He's brilliant. And I encourage you guys to write down rsr.org and search Walt Brown and listen to him explain his theory. They did Walt Brown Week. See, when I was Christian, I couldn't put this all together. I was still an evolutionist because I'd never seen anything other than that. And my cousin sent me a copy of this video called The Age of the Earth, Kent Hovind. And it connected all the dots. It's like, oh, the fossils are a sign of a flood, not millions of years. And God's word is true. And it's not just a Sunday book. It's accurate in every area. But I wasn't taught that in school. I was taught a lie in school. And you can't prop up a lie with truth. So he showed all the lies that the government schools were teaching me. And the biggest hurdle for me was, you mean the encyclopedias are wrong? And the textbooks are wrong? And I'm here to say yes, because they have a godless foundation. They don't allow for a creator. And if you can't build it on the truth, it's going to be wrong. Like Bob Enyart said, if you start with nothing plus nothing equals everything, there's no limit to the amount of mistakes you're going to make. And they're wrong time and time and time again. But the professor that looked at the book, she said, you know, she wouldn't accept that theory, the assumption that there was water inside the earth. And I said, you know, and other people, I don't believe there was water under the oceans back then. It's like, why not? There's water under the oceans today. They got these black smokers, these hydrothermal vents coming from the underneath the ocean. Well, where does it have to come from? Below the ocean. So there's water underneath the ocean today. And in Germany and Russia, we talked about the granite sealing off all the water. But in Germany and Russia, they dug down. And they were shocked at what they found. They found crushed granite with water. And they couldn't go any deeper. So anyhow, rsr.org, if you search answers, there's people that object to this theory. And it could be wrong. Parts of it could be wrong. I am fully aware of that. And if it is, then we change the theory. That's what science is. We aren't going to censor an opposing view, which is what the government schools do. Government schools censor creation. You can't think about it in their classroom. And if you bring it up, you could get fired. That's a whole nother talk. But you go into rsr.org and you can see all the information on it. And at the bottom, these are the objections, published criticisms. There's some criticism of the theory. And then they answer the criticism. So you can get all the information. That's what science is. But then how come, you know, this is an astounding theory. Who's ever heard of the hydroplate theory before? Anybody? One. Okay. Two maybe. Okay. Yeah, the vast majority have never heard of it. And why is that? Because just like the evolutionists censor the creationists were censoring the hydroplate, which really irritates me because if we would have been banging this drum the last 40 years, we'd have so much clout in the scientific community. It's like, we predicted what you'd find in a comet. What have you done? But it's been censored. And if you want to see why it's been censored, there's a... The published list, there's the Walt Brown controversy at the bottom of that page. There's a controversy, and Jane Albright, she looks through all the documents, she lays it all out there. And yeah, if you're interested in that, and hopefully that never, ever, 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 ever happens again. Hopefully ideas are judged based on their merit, not based on whatever that has stopped it. But so I, you know, for the last few years, my goal was to get Walt Brown the credit he deserves before he dies. And a couple of years ago, I saw a write-up in Creation Matters where they took a look at the flood theories, and they included the hydroplate. I was so excited. And they gave an accurate representation of it. I was so excited. And last December, Kevin Lee was able to present the hydroplate theory at ICR. And that was so exciting because Dr. Galuza, he's the new CEO of ICR, he said, I want to hear what the hydroplate theory people say. I don't want to hear what people say about the hydroplate theory. And so he invited him in and he showed it, and they showed the Brian Nickel animation of it. And it was very well received with minor exceptions. But I'm so excited because I think this is the silver bullet for the creationists, where we can explain thing at time after time. And then Randy Galuza's got the other silver bullet for biology, where there he shows how animals adapt to their environment rapidly. They're designed to sense the environment they're in, and that determines how they develop. Like if you're a cave, if you're living in a cave, you don't need eyes. And guess what? That blind cave fish, they can do that rapidly. It's not millions of years of chance random mutations. That doesn't work at all. And evolutionists know that. So they just sweep it under the rug. And that rug's getting pretty small right now. We need more people pointing at the rug saying, look under that. And that's why we need creation clubs. I try to get creation clubs because we meet in Northwestern and in St. Paul every month. And I wanted to get the students at Northwestern didn't even know about it. It's like, well, we need a creation club here so we can at least announce it in chapel. And so we started a club there. I wanted to get one in every campus. I've helped St. Cloud State start a Bible club. Brainerd, I helped him start a Bible club. I almost got one going in Liberty. But anyhow, you can pray about that. But this is where the battle is. We need to be able to expose the holes of the evolutionists, their faulty theories and faulty policies that those theories are based upon come crumbling down. And you'll see the importance of that. And I would encourage you to check out this hydroplate.org. See when that conference is going to be, and just check it out. I think it's going to be free. There's going to be some really good speakers on it. And then spread it, and then share it. And here's some good resources. I encourage you to share this stuff as much as you can. The Hydroplate Theory, rsr.org, that's my favorite site. That's what I listen to when I'm going around, driving all these hours to different places. I listen to RSR because he's funny. He talks to some of the best creationists out there, and he'll have me cracking up sometimes. There was one time I was at a stoplight, and Fred Williams goes, you know, evolution's not even a theory. It's a low-grade hypothesis. And Bob says, it's not a low-grade hypothesis. It's a high-grade fever-induced delusion. And he was right, and that's how they got it. But I'll leave those up there for you to write down. I've got it just a few minutes. Does anybody have a question or a comment? It's kind of a sip out of a fire hose. But I encourage you to check it out. Listen to the RSR and Walt Brown in his own words. Today's Isaac Newton is in our midst, and nobody knows it. It's just brilliant. All right. Well, with that, we will give you a break for 10 minutes. Thank you so much. You are dismissed.